Portland, 90.7 FM on your dial, or KBOO.FM online. Time is coming up on 9 o'clock, and up next is the Old Mole Variety Hour. This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Aladdin Theater, presenting An Evening with Leon Russell, Wednesday, October 29th. Tickets and information for An Evening with Leon Russell on October 29th are available at aladdin-theater.com. It's also been made possible by a grant from the League of Women Voters of Portland, helping to make democracy work by reminding first-time Oregon voters that the voter registration deadline is October 14. Registering to vote by mail or online is easy. Information at lwvpdx.org. That's lwvpdx.org.
Wish I was a mole in the ground. Wish I was a mole in the ground. 'Cause if I was a mole in the ground, I'd tear those mountains down.
I'm Joe Clement, your host for the Old Mole Variety Hour today. You're listening to it on KBOO.FM or on your dial if you still listen to a terrestrial radio at 90.7 FM. The Old Mole is a political magazine of sorts, but built for the radio. We bring you different kinds of content, from interviews to commentary to kind of more creative outlets of our thinking, burrowing minds. On today's show, we're going to start out with Bill Resnick talking with Dr. Walter Sue, who's an expert about public health, and I'm going to be considering the social foundations of public health and really kind of responding to some concerns in light of the Ebola outbreak in West Africa. Fran Michelle is going to be bringing us The Well-Read Red again today about gentrification as a form of class domination as well as kind of a cultural shift. And in that theme, I'm going to be talking with James Tracy, author of Dispatchers Against Displacement, Field Notes from San Francisco's Housing War, also about this issue of gentrification and the real-world strategies for resisting displacement that he's worked on and other people have worked on. He's going to be in town next Sunday on the 19th at Reading Frenzy, talking about the book and kind of having facilitating a roundtable discussion. And to round out today's show, Jan Hocken and Mike Snedeker, our Left in the Law duo, are going to be talking about a recent report by the Sentencing Project that looks at perceptions of race and crime and the different inclinations towards punitive versus restorative justice that show up along racial lines. But we're now going to turn to Bill Resnick after a bit of a musical clip by Hazel Dickens and Alice Gerard that might remind you of why you're listening to today's show.
Hey, 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 got the early Monday morning working blues. I put on my reggae worn out working shoes. Oh, well, the weekend was too short, but I can't choose. When the Lord made the working girl, he made the blues. Well, I'm tired of working my life away and giving somebody else all of my pay while they get rich on the profits that I lose and leaving me
Dr. Walter Tsu, welcome to KBOO.
Well, thank you, Bill. It's a pleasure to be here.
Dr. Walter Tsu is past president of the American Public Health Association and former health commissioner of the city of Philadelphia. He's been honored and decorated by peers in healthcare and public health. But as to the public, he's just one of those unsung heroes who have given their lives to keeping people healthy and avoiding or reducing the impact of mass epidemics like Ebola, which, if appropriate action is not taken, really now threaten the world. Dr. Tsu, this country lavishes money on treating individual patients, that is, those with money or decent health insurance. And, of course, the familiar interests, many familiar interests, get rich doing that. But as to public health, it is sort of the orphan child that no one really wants to support and doesn't have much of a voice. Dr. Tsu, we'll be getting to Ebola and epidemics and the campaign that public health must lead. But first, tell us about the multiple responsibilities of any nation's public health system.
Well, that's a great question to start with. What people often forget is that the foundation upon which you build any healthcare system is public health. And what is public health? Public health is what we as a society do to assure conditions so that people can be healthy. So anytime you get efforts to make sure the water is clean, the air is fresh to breathe, the food is nutritious, all of those are aspects to how we maintain public health. And if you think about it, when public health does its job right, people don't notice it. You know, we take for granted much of those things in our society, and that's actually an indication of a good public health system.
You also, though, when diseases are found and you're always monitoring them, you also then, especially if they're infectious, and you make sure there are vaccinations and all the other things, but when the disease does threaten an outbreak, you monitor it, right? Send people out and find people with, let's say, tuberculosis, and sometimes isolate people with particularly terrible diseases that are infectious. That's also a public health responsibility, I gather.
It is. Public health has both a diagnostic and a treatment responsibility. So in tuberculosis, we can both diagnose it, and we actually send outreach workers frequently with people with active tuberculosis, and they actually knock on the door and watch people take their medications. But we also have a regulatory role where we could actually quarantine people who need to be isolated in cases where there are serious epidemics.
Dr. Tsu, let's get into infectious diseases and epidemics. Ebola now threatening the planet, it's not the only one, though. It seems to me there's been a series of threats over the last several years. There's SARS, what's it called, Clostridium, food poisoning, cholera outbreaks, TB, mercury and lead poisoning in special areas. How does public health prevent outbreaks and deal with them, especially the infectious diseases?
Well, one of the most important roles that public health does in cooperation with doctors, hospitals, laboratories, is to do disease surveillance. So there are certain reportable diseases and conditions in our society that have to be reported to a central agency, and in most societies, that's the health department. And that health department then tracks and counts data when there seems to be a blip and something is much higher than expected. People frequently try to identify where this is coming from. Certain diseases, obviously, like measles or, let's say, tuberculosis, are ones that are a particular concern. And those diseases are ones where even one case is enough to launch an investigation.
Yeah, you need boots on the ground, right? There has to be public health departments everywhere, as well as national coordination, particularly with all the data coming in and examinations.
Well, yeah, absolutely. You need boots on the ground. In fact, thinking about just one case of something like what happened in Texas, where they had a case of Ebola, there were literally hundreds of people who were involved in one way or another, actually identifying who the contacts were, treating the person who actually was ill, and doing questions, isolating people, educating people around diseases like that. So it's a huge, massive effort, very labor-intensive, and someone like public health is the lead in trying to do those type of investigations, which is an important responsibility in our society.
And things like the tuberculosis show up everywhere. There's constant need, right? And syphilis. All of them have been sort of dealt with in the United States, so there's a fairly, very low incidence. That's really a triumph of public health in the United States, it seems to me. But there's still some, and it requires people going out and investigating, right?
Absolutely, and it's a lot of work, actually. People don't fully appreciate what's involved. We had patients that we took care of with drug-resistant tuberculosis, and we had to have our staff give them their medications around the clock, 365 days, even on Christmas Day, the nurses would show up to give them their medicine. So really a lot of unsung heroes out there who work in public health.
This is KBOO Radio, 90.7 FM, Portland, Oregon. Bill Resnick for the Old Mole Variety Hour. I'm talking to Dr. Walter Tzu, who's a public health practitioner, was the head of the American Public Health Association. He's still active and still struggling for public health. We've been talking about how important it is, how public health is only gets into the news when there's a failure. Public health system in the United States has had many, many triumphs, and but is, of course, being cut back now. And let's talk about that. Besides Ebola, Dr. Tzu, the threats of infectious disease, it seems to me, are heightening. Why is that?
Well, first off, there seems to be a new disease every year that we're encountering in public health, ones that often have never been discovered or identified before. There's one right now called enterovirus D68, which has a sort of this long name, but it's actually causing severe respiratory illnesses in young kids. There have actually been deaths associated with this. Other people have attributed actually a type of paralysis. So these are things that weren't there last year, and we can anticipate that as each year goes by, a new discovery is made, which will challenge the public health system and the medical community.
It seems to me that part of it is obviously people not getting vaccinated. That's one problem, irrational fear of vaccination. But there's also the problem, you mentioned it earlier, drug-resistant diseases. A lot of it has to do with industrial agriculture now, or at least that's the speculation. But there's many more, like tuberculosis, for example, or now some parts, kinds of pneumonia, apparently. There's almost no drugs to treat it.
Yeah, that is a great concern, is what they call antibiotic resistance. A lot of it has been fostered because people are given antibiotics when they really have a viral illness, and antibiotics really don't work for viruses. Other times, people take their medicines partly, and they don't finish the bottle, and then what happens is they don't fully eradicate the bacteria, and the bacteria learns to adapt and eventually develop resistance. All of these are reasons why it's very important to follow the instructions from your physician, but it's also a reason why physicians have to be judicious about using drugs like antibiotics, because antibiotic-resistant bacteria is something that actually is much more expensive and much more difficult to treat.
It's also globalization creates a threat. You know, we're getting food from all over the world, and we're also, people are moving around much, much more quickly. Ebola was once sort of confined to some small parts of Africa because people couldn't move. Now they move into cities. The cities have airports. The whole world is sort of connected in this economic globalization, which in some ways has been semi-productive, and in many ways it's just enriched the rich. That can't be stopped. And in fact, that all leads back to Ebola. A lot of people are arguing that, well, why don't we just quarantine those nations and not let anybody, any of the people in until the disease is somehow wiped out or whatever, but we have to protect our people. What's wrong with that?
Well, first off, it's totally unrealistic that we can close air travel even in Western Africa. It would actually be counterproductive. There's always alternative ways that people would actually try to leave the country, and often those are methods that could actually be even more difficult because more people could come in contact with those individuals trying alternative routes. So the advantage actually is that we do screenings prior to boarding airplanes. We tell people that they cannot get on, and we now test their temperatures before they can get on to make sure that they don't have fevers. If you actually are not symptomatic, you cannot transmit something like Ebola. And, of course, then there is incumbent upon the healthcare system surveillance and vigilance to make sure that people who do come off those flights don't come down with fevers or illnesses. And if they do, that they are promptly seen and diagnosed and treated if possible. This actually raises an important issue in America, because one of our greatest challenges is that we have a healthcare system that does not open its doors to everybody, people without health insurance. Many people who are immigrants have difficulty negotiating the healthcare system. And frankly, that could be a mechanism in which people would be denied coverage and then risk possibly spreading a disease, a communicable disease. So just closing the doors to say people cannot fly out of a country, I believe, is going to be counterproductive and not enforceable.
Yeah, and it also means you're not going to be able to fly into the country. And in order to reduce the disease incidence right to close to zero, that could be done. It's still not impossible. They have to get a lot of help, it seems to me. Those are very, very poor countries. And the rich countries, just putting aside any kind of, you know, humanity and a sense of brotherhood amongst peoples, it's really in the interest of all of the rich countries to try to make sure the disease is kept in one or two cases a year rather than what they're seeing now, which is this exponential growth and dying people.
Well, you're raising actually an important issue here that has a larger theme. We've known about Ebola since around 1976, so we've had like almost 30 years of experience. We know it's a very deadly disease. Yet all that time, we have not had any research dollars devoted to developing a cure or a vaccine. And now we're realizing that that was probably a huge mistake because we're going to be spending billions, really, to try to stop this epidemic. And that money really could have been much more fruitfully invested in trying to find a treatment or cure or vaccine. So shame on us as developing world that we could have been developing some type of treatments for Ebola early on instead of scrambling like we are doing right now to find anything that might be a cure.
This is Bill Resnick for the Old Mill Variety Hour talking to Dr. Walter Tzu, who was the president of the American Public Health Association, has had many honors, although one of those unsung heroes. Dr. Tzu, public health is so important. We've been talking about how nobody recognizes it, however, until there's a crisis, and then they want something to happen. Why is it that because it's sort of not very well known, and for other reasons, public health budgets, in fact, in the United States have been cut pretty severely in the last 5 or 10 years, even though that the threats are greater, they're not returning to their former levels, and much more is needed. Why is that?
Well, public health is dependent upon government funding. I, as a physician, can only take care of a few patients with an illness, but when public health works well, it's when hundreds or thousands of doctors working together in concert can help take care of tens of thousands of patients. That's when we can really have a huge impact on the community. But that cannot be done by individual dollars. You need tax dollars to help fund a large program like that. So we are taxpayer dependent. And as you know, we've gone through a recent recession. There were huge cutbacks, something like 20,000 or 30,000 public health workers were actually laid off during this past recession. And we're trying to recover now, but many state and local governments have been slow about hiring back at the public health workers that were laid off. And so now we're faced with an epidemic potentially of this enterovirus that I mentioned earlier, or maybe the threat of Ebola. And we're scrambling to find enough qualified workers out there who can actually help us address these potential threats. So what I say is that we underfund public health at great peril to this country and, for that matter, any country.
We do really well, however, at funding the military. That seems to be a priority of the people, of the elites of this country, who are ignoring many other threats. In fact, the threat of climate change is also a huge public health issue, and we didn't get to that, although we did on the Old Mole fairly recently talk about climate change and health with Pat O'Haron. Dr. Walter Tzu, thanks so much for talking to us.
Well, you're more than welcome. Thanks, Bill, for inviting me.
La maladie était chez nos voisins, libériens ou guinéens. On croyait que c'était au loin, qu'on n'avait pas à s'inquiéter. Mais finalement, elle nous a atteint. On a peur maintenant même de serrer des mains, de prendre les transports en commun. On est effrayé d'être contaminé. Même si la frontière a été fermée, malgré tout ça, elle est quand même arrivée. Tout le pays est paniqué. Finalement, Ebola est là. Viande grosse, il faut pas manger. Matin, midi, soir, les mains, il faut les laver.
Éviter la saleté, faut beaucoup prier. Finalement, Ebola est là, est là, est là. Ebola est là, est là, est là. On a beau l'éviter, finalement, il est là. Elle a, elle a, et faut beaucoup prier parce que Ebola est là, elle a, elle a,
You are listening to KBOO Portland, the Old Mole Variety Hour. I'm Joe Clement, your host. That little bit of music that we just heard was a detourned version of a song by Rihanna that is about advising the Liberian people basically about the realities of Ebola. There's a lot of concern over there that the talk of Ebola was just a political scam, and it represents, you know, a kind of cultural intervention that actually happens a lot on the radio over there. Before that, Bill Resnick and Walter Sue were talking about the kind of social underpinnings of our public health system and the ways that, you know, this... the way that this makes us susceptible to things like Ebola. But I'm now on the phone with James Tracy. James Tracy is the author of Dispatches Against Displacement, Field Notes from San Francisco's Housing War. For that book, he draws a lot on his experiences in the San Francisco Bay Area as a community organizer and one of the co-founders of a community land trust down there, which we will talk a bit more about later. Thanks for coming on the Old Mole, James.
Thanks for having me.
Could you give us a definition of just what gentrification is, and then we can move into your suggestion and other people's suggestions for how we might respond to it?
Well, gentrification is actually a very simple term. It's the economic process of replacing poor and working class communities with middle and upper class communities in a neighborhood.
Your book, Dispatches Against Displacement, focuses on the San Francisco area, but gentrification is alive and unfortunately well in many major U.S. cities, including Portland. It's happened to me. Earlier this year, I was displaced from my home in Selwood. I was living in an apartment that was one of five in this large house that was cut up into several apartments on a large property. It was bought by developers who then got the city's approval to tear it down and build four houses that would sell for several $100,000 each, I'm sure. Could you speak to how gentrification comes about because of place-specific reasons, but also for reasons that are endemic to the way that our economy and the housing market work?
When we look at displacement, which is happening in almost every major American city as we speak, we see different engines. In San Francisco, we certainly have seen the engine of what we call tech displacement, of, you know, the growing tech industry and the economic inequalities that it brings being a major fuel behind displacement. In Detroit, the major engines of displacement is actually in reverse. It's the disinvestment of the city. But in all cases, no matter what city you're in, it really comes down to local expressions of neoliberal economics, the deregulation of capital, and its impacts on local neighborhoods.
So on the one hand, you have the people who are actually moving in and who represent a different class in society. The class whose power as a class is defined by their ownership of money and what it can buy. But then on the other hand, there is this government level of coordination that is about rewriting laws and otherwise opening the channels for capital or profit, if we're not being strict Marxists about it, to shape our society and just the way that we actually inhabit the earth according to its needs.
I think sometimes in the displacement conversations that we have, we often focus on a lot of the symptoms of the problem, We focus on hipsters with their funny beards and mustaches and vegan donuts, but really they're not the main drivers of the problem. They're the symptoms and eventually, in some cases, even the victims of the larger problem. The real problem that we have is a real estate industry that cannot provide housing, you know, in an affordable and safe and decent fashion for the vast amount of people who need it in most cities in the United States. Those are the people who are calling the shots, that are deciding what type of development goes into our neighborhoods and what is kept out, who is let into the neighborhoods and who is kept out. So I really always encourage people to keep your eye on the people who are really really calling the shots and doing the damage.
So Dispatches Against Displacement is about documenting gentrification, but it's also about documenting real-world examples of alternative institutions as well as ideas for them that we might employ to meet our housing needs and to quote-unquote own land and steward it. Could you speak to what these alternatives are, but also the reality that we're in that we have to disabuse ourselves of because we've come to see it as just how housing happens?
We're always going to have ongoing urban crises, and those situations will translate into further housing crises as long as we have the vast amount of housing in the private market. We have to shift to and experiment with different forms of community ownership. In San Francisco, I helped found an organization called the San Francisco Community Land Trust, which works with tenants and works with organizations who are fighting displacement to not just stop an eviction, but then to take property into the cooperative sector where residents can be cooperative owners, can are prohibited from speculating on their properties, from making vast amount of profits from it, and basically where the land is held in the, you know, in the community's hands in perpetuity.
What, if any, dangers are there to even these options being on the table as housing markets displace the people who might want to pursue these alternative institutions from any position of potentially owning the land they live on or acting collectively to secure it?
Displacement comes with a certain story. You know, the gentrification automatically improves a neighborhood and will lift all boats, so to speak. It tells a very neoliberal story. It tells a story of individual achievement and coping with change instead of actively taking a part in your community and improving it for the people who are actually there before new people are welcomed in. I don't think anybody wants cities that never grow and never change and are bastions of xenophobia either. However, displacement story is that working class communities, other communities of color, are actually secondary in the urban analysis. That maybe you'll get a little benefit out of it here or there, but that's really not the main point. The main point is to drive home private profit and make people feel like that's just natural, right? That all, you know, there are no other urban alternatives.
I want to go back for a moment and ask you what community land trusts are and why we might pursue them.
Sure. Community land trusts, in a nutshell, they're organizations that hold housing in trust, keep it affordable in perpetuity by owning the land that the buildings are built on, where the residents own a limited equity stake in the building, but not so much that they could ever make immense personal profit off of it. The idea is to keep housing affordable for generations to come.
Now, before we wrap up, could you say a bit about the book talk you're going to be coming up here to give next Sunday, when and where it'll be, and what people might expect when they come?
Yeah, so we'll be at one of Portland's finest literary institutions, Reading Frenzy. That's 3628 North Mississippi Avenue in Portland, Oregon. And you know, I'll do a short reading and expect a roundtable discussion on strategies to fight displacement. We have over a dozen local organizations that are co-sponsoring, and I hope that this book can be a catalyst to get people to, you know, think long-term, create new strategies, and most importantly, new alliances.
I'm Joe Clement for the Old Mole Variety Hour. I've been talking with James Tracy, author of Dispatches Against Displacement, Field Notes from San Francisco's Housing War. Thanks for coming on to talk with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
You never carry money. You like your life ordered and clean.
The well-read...
I'm now on the phone with... on to talk with us.
Marvels of marble and silver and glass. You take the earth out of the earth. You throw the corpses in. One crop is as good as another, as long as the cash keeps pouring in. The wheels must never stop turning. The machine must be obeyed. The future has got to be fueled, and there's a price to be paid.
You're listening to the Old Mole Variety Hour. I'm your host, Joe Clement. That little song clip that we played, although there was a bit of a glitch, was Leon Rosselson's Who Reaps the Profits, Who Pays the Price. Before that, I was talking with James Tracy about gentrification and his book, Dispatches Against Displacement. That song is really neat, I think, because, and we'll link you to it on the website when this goes up in a day or two, kboo.fm/Old Mole Variety Hour. We'll link you to it because it's about colonialism in the English context, and but also with vague references to dark skin and to other worldly kinds of colonialism. It draws out the special role that capitalist values seem to have always played in colonialism. And continuing this line of thought, our well-read red, Fran Michel, is now going to bring us the well-read red about the displacement of people that we call gentrification as, you know, a form of class domination and not just racial, but both at the same time.
The well-read Red has been reading about gentrification, as well as seeing plenty of it. Despite what we often hear in mainstream media, gentrification is not simply a cultural change in a neighborhood and not simply a matter of individual choices. Rather, it involves changes in property ownership driven by structural economic forces and backed by state power. As Ronnie Flores notes in socialistworker.com, gentrification is the result of capitalism, a system characterized by the relentless pursuit of profit. Drawing on the work of Neil Smith, Flores points out that when there's a wide enough gap between the current rent in an area and the potential rent that can be made if it were to undergo reinvestment, a project for gentrification is born. This rent gap is the mechanism underlying gentrification. Similarly, Gavin Mueller in Jacobin observes that gentrification has always been a top-down affair, not a spontaneous hipster influx, orchestrated by the real estate developers and investors who pull the strings of city policy, with individual homebuyers deployed in mopping up operations. Focusing on the example of Washington, D.C., Mueller points out that the first installment of D.C. gentrification began as the smoke lifted after the riots following Martin Luther King's assassination. Large parts of the black areas of the city were burned. With the fear of urban insurrection hanging in the air, property values plummeted, paving the way for local real estate magnates to snap up hugely lucrative portfolios. Developers succeeded in getting the city government and banks to assist in their purchases, promising community projects like homeless shelters and hospitals that they rarely delivered before they flipped the property. Currently, the area's fortunes are managed by the Downtown DC Business Improvement District, or BID. Among their tactics, implementing mandatory fees to price out small businesses, hiring non-union workers to pick up trash and check parking meters, encouraging crackdowns on poor and homeless residents to push them out. The Downtown DC BID was one of the first organizations to raise an alarm about Occupy DC's encampment and to insist on a police response throughout the entire occupation. A powerful capitalist class of bankers, real estate developers, and investors is driving gentrification, using a mixture of huge loans, to which only they have access, and government funding to push land values higher. This leaves D.C.'s professional class with a choice. If their household income is in the six-figure range, they can generally secure mortgages in gentrifying neighborhoods, buy property, have low-wage workers fix it up for cheap, and reasonably hope to ride these property values into a secure position in the middle class. Or they can pay exorbitant rent until they move back to Peoria. Not much of a choice. If they buy, they're putting everything on the line, albeit a line that, in D.C., has only gone one way in the past decade. Tying up your assets, your middle-class future, in home values does something to people. It alters their interests. It sutures a professional class of liberal and even progressive beliefs to the rapacious capitalist expansion into the city. The people who move to gentrifying areas tend to have liberal, tolerant, cosmopolitan sympathies. But they're aligned materially with reactionary and oppressive city restructuring, pushing them into antagonism with established residents who do nothing for property values. This produces racism. Racism isn't just a bad feeling in your heart, as a liberal believes when she insists she isn't at all racist. It's a force that emerges from the pressures of maintaining one's own position and the resentments that spring forth from this process. It produces fear and hatred of the poor for being poor, for having any pretense of being on equal footing with the propertied. It is a hatred for the potential threat to the property values which underpin a tenuous future among the professional middle class. This bubbles up into everyday life in all sorts of ways. Mueller describes the discomfort, the rage and fear shown by a nice white man in response to the noisy black and brown kids in the neighborhood. Quote, "Young black bodies have been mass culture's symbol for irrational savage violence for decades, for centuries, and so the whites fear them. And this fear can manifest as anger, as callousness, as hatred. And yet, Washington's rate of violent crime against whites is lower than the national average. White skin is quite literally a protection from harm. But it doesn't insulate your property values. That requires extra vigilance." Noting that really the teens of color have much more to fear from the whites living alongside them, Mueller continues, "We can leverage state violence against them. We can call the cops. On message boards, police officers urge gentrifiers to report any suspicious activity, which includes legal activity such as walking, talking, and standing. Smoking weed in the alley? Call the cops. A group of teenagers talking loudly? Call the cops. Litter? Call the cops. Just whatever you do, don't actually approach people. State repression is the solution to all problems." The liberal discourse on gentrification has absolutely nothing to say about finance or prison, the two most salient institutions in urban life. Instead, it does what liberal discourse so often does. It buries the structural forces at work and choreographs a dance about individual choice to perform on the grave. We get tiny dramas over church parking lots and bike lanes and soccer fields. Gentrification becomes a culture war, a battle over consumer choices. Gourmet cupcake shop or fried chicken joint? Can we all live side by side eating gourmet pickles with our fried fish sandwiches? "What choice do I have?" ask the liberal gentrifiers if you press them a bit. "This is the only place I can afford to live." This sums up everything perfectly, puncturing the bubble of individual choices that make up liberal politics. You have no choice. Everything's been decided ahead of time. If you want the American dream of a middle-class life with a home you own in the city in which you work, you have few other choices than to join the shock troops of the onslaught against the urban poor. Align with big capital and the repressive state in the conquest of the city, and maybe you'll have enough equity to send your kids to college. Sure, you may feel a bit of guilt, but when it comes down to it, you're still calling the cops at the slightest provocation. After all, it's not just trendy bars and cafes at stake. It's the yuppies' privileged position in ruling class administration, one of the dwindling means toward any semblance of economic and social stability in this time of crisis. Marx called the violent expropriation of the poor from their lands primitive accumulation. But as Mueller notes, it is not a one-time sin in the distant past. It accompanies capitalist development every step of the way, wherever land value meets valueless humanity. Because of this, David Harvey has suggested calling this process instead accumulation by dispossession. Harvey is among those who've taken up the work of Henri Lefebvre, whose 1968 text on the right to the city has provided a name for movement against the projects of urban dispossession and neoliberal gentrification. Harvey notes that the right to the city is far more than the individual liberty to access urban resources. It is a right to change ourselves by changing the city. It is, moreover, a common rather than an individual right, since this transformation inevitably depends on the exercise of a collective power to reshape the process of urbanization. The World Charter of the Right to the City, that came out of the World Social Forum in 2004, seeks to promote the just distribution of the benefits and responsibilities resulting from the urbanization process. fulfillment of the social functions of the city and of property, distribution of urban income, and democratization of access to land and public services for all citizens, especially those with less economic resources and in situations of vulnerability. In the U.S., the National Right to the City Alliance affirms that everyone, particularly the disenfranchised, not only has a right to the city, but as inhabitants, have a right to shape it, design it, and put in practice an urban human rights agenda. Here in Portland, the Right to the City Coalition commits to empowering working-class people in Portland's political process and promoting a progressive vision different than that of Portland's current elected leaders, who are primarily responsive to big business. Their next meeting is Sunday, November 9th at 3 p.m. at Concordia University's library. Check their website for more at righttothecitypdx.org. For the Old Mole Variety Hour, this has been Fran Michel.
Now there's always been a bottom, and there's always been a top. And someone took the orders, someone called a shot.
You are listening to the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO Portland. I'm your host, Joe Clement. That was James Talley singing "Are They Gonna Make Outlaws Out of Us Again?" And before that, Fran Michel was bringing us the well-read read about the vicious way that, or the vicious cycle of colonization by middle-class, capital-driven housing development and perceptions of inclinations to or dispositions to crime. And to wrap up today's show, our Left in the Law duo, Jan Hocken and Mike Snedeker, are going to be talking about a recent report by the Sentencing Project called Race and Punishment, Racial Perceptions of Crime and Support for Punitive Policies. This is an interesting report that, you know, kind of shows the way that not only are class biases in a material way creating perceptions of racism, but racial perceptions themselves are guiding the way that the state represses poor people. Jan and Mike?
Well, Mike, let's start by talking some about the Sentencing Project report and the organization itself. As we all know, there are investments, including among think tanks and universities, in the findings they discover and the lens through which those findings are produced. What about the Sentencing Project?
It's an organization everybody should know about, Jen. It's in Washington, D.C. It's got an innocuous name, but what they do is they synthesize studies that are done all over the country of interest to their subject, which is basically crime and punishment and the entire justice system. And they do their own research as well. And they put together a series of reports on that get into detailed analysis of the realities of incarceration, historical realities, present realities, the realities of how the criminal justice system functions, and any aspect of it, juvenile justice, probation. They've got a paper, or they've done something pretty smart that puts together a lot of hard facts. So if you ever have an intuitive feeling about how things are going, if you want to back it up or even maybe undo it, you should go to thesentencingproject.org.
And they're natural allies of the Old Moles because they look not only for the horrific picture that unfolds around the criminal justice system and the problem of racism, but also potential for meaningful reforms and change. And certainly this report tries to take up both. Well, let's start with the bad news of the report and what they see as a critical juncture we're at as a country around our criminal justice system. What's the general gist of these findings?
Well, they start by describing it the way it is. And what they show is that despite significant advances in feeling about other races since the 1940s. The fact is that right now our criminal justice system is racist to the core. There are so many variances between the races that can only be explained by racism. There are, at every aspect, from initial arrests to whether or not you're going to get bailed out after you've been arrested. One quick study shows that in 2010, as far as we know about drug use, black people were just slightly more likely than white people to actually smoke dope. But the arrest rates are nearly four times as high for black people. So all the way from the beginning contact with the criminal justice system to whether or not you're going to be sentenced to death, your race is a major predictor and sometimes the only way to account for differences. They've done a variety of studies where they've equalized everything else, your prior records, your economic position. They've done their very best to find people who are in every other way identical. And yet there's a huge disparity that can really only be explained by race.
Part one of the important findings in the report centers on public perceptions of race and crime, which suggests that white Americans, although they don't kind of disaggregate that category of white Americans, and there may be class and important difference, gender differences there for sure, but in general, though parts of the public that do not directly interact with the criminal justice system tend to see it as fairer, and these very problems that you're describing as an effect of higher crime rates among black and Latino communities, which suggests that the criminal justice system is supported by a public that and by a media that features these cases in particular ways. And they describe this as a difference between an old Jim Crow racism and what they call a kinder, gentler anti-black ideology and form of racial prejudice. Can you summarize that aspect of their findings, or can you talk about it?
Sure. You know, that's the beauty of this report is precisely that it looks at how can this be? It's an age where we have a black president, where all the rhetoric on the surface seems to be against the sort of crude racism, where many parts of life, the world of sports, the world of academia, people are continually getting in trouble for being racist, and there's more of a sense of enforcement, whereas the criminal justice system persists in being hugely slanted.
And so what you're describing is the breakdown of an old Jim Crow that was legally sanctioned and officially authorized.
Well, yeah, I'm describing the persistence of racism in this particular part of American life. How does it happen that people get promptly busted if they make a vaguely racist remark in the NBA, but the same kind of remarks are made every day all over the country and without effect in the criminal justice system? And the answer is the sort of implicit support for the present system, for that kind of racism. There's a host of studies summarized in this report about, for example, the attitude. If a white person happens to think that black people are generally less intelligent, maybe 25% of white people do now, as opposed to 85% 50 years ago. But that residue is far more likely to support the death penalty, to support punitive measures within the criminal justice system, because they believe the criminal justice system is precisely for incarcerating and limiting the actions of black and brown people. Their own relationships to it are far more limited. They don't have nearly as much contact with the criminal justice system, and it's more likely to be favorable. And so to the extent that there are people have racist attitudes, that is an excellent predictor of their support for the present criminal justice system or for more punitive measures, for more racist punitive measures.
And how would you then distinguish between that form of racism and what's called implicit racial bias, which is also known as unconscious racial bias?
Well, that's the sort of racial bias that almost every white person has, the way you flinch when you see a black kid with a hoodie, the way that people have a set of expectations of behaviors of people they see on the street or in a classroom that translates into a racist bias. And often there will be some way in which black people are, say, a little more threatening in reality by a tiny percentage, but that gets extrapolated into a massive threat. And the way the media covers crime is that white people are more likely to be individualized. They'll have names. They'll have contexts. Black and brown people are more likely to remain anonymous, to be, it's as if their race is sufficient explanation for the crime to have happened. There's the media presentation of crime is completely out of touch with the reality of crime. And crime has been dropping steadily for decades. The murder rates in every big town, regardless of what the law enforcement policies are down, down, down. You would not know that from watching the news. So there is a way in which the general descriptions and public perception of crime remains racist, even with and for people who genuinely believe themselves and in many ways are not overtly racist, or and who try consciously not to be racist at all.
You know, how this is, of course, a fear of crime, and crime as a coded way of talking about race has a long and dreadful history. And, you know, the Willie Horton campaign comes to mind as one of those examples, when Dukakis was charged with being lenient on crime when it was actually about racism and more liberal sentencing practices. But is this also taking a more subtle form now than the Willie Horton campaign?
Well, yes. I mean, there have been studies trying to look at and root out this implicit racism. And some of them are like shooter studies, where you'll have white people, typically college students, deciding whether or not to pull a trigger when they see people who are threatening or people who are not threatening. And they're told to shoot the people who are armed and to not shoot the people who are not armed. They're far more quick to shoot black people who are armed than white people who are armed. There are various studies in which an ambiguous instrument could be a tool or could be a weapon. If it's being held by a black person, white people will far more likely to identify it as a weapon than if the person holding that is a white person. So there are implicit assumptions that are being brought out by really ingenious studies of implicit bias. And one interesting note is that Denver police, mostly white, since it's a mostly white town, are less likely than an average white person to prematurely shoot and kill a black person who's carrying a weapon. They're also biased. They're more likely they'll shoot quicker at black people who are armed than they will at white people who are armed.
Once the presence of a weapon has been established, yeah, they're less likely to engage in other strategies for disarming the person. So they've been trained to be sensitized. They've been sensitized to some aspects of this. But you're saying there are other racial biases then that override whatever inhibitions have been trained in them.
Well, the training makes them look good by comparison with other untrained white people, but they remain biased. That bias is there.
And of course, when in the area of unconscious or implicit bias, people can say, well, we're not responsible for our unconscious, but more for conscious racism. So what do we do at the level of making the unconscious conscious, as psychoanalysts would say, interpreting this really destructive and hateful side of a societal psychic readiness to deny people so much of their humanity? What's the basis now for moving in the direction of meaningful reforms that are described in the report?
Well, I think that sort of implied racism can be changed by factual realities of publicizing the extent to which the system remains racist. It's implicitly supported, but people cannot consciously you know, live with themselves and say, I support a completely racist system. So to publicize all the ways in which the system effectively functions in a racist way at every level is effective. And people, in fact, are now more inclined, they're less concerned with crime. Crime and the death penalty were the only political issues in the 70s and 80s. But that's not so now. There's a host of other issues that are generally more important. And I think it's a good time to do things like ban the box, which is the restrictions placed on people after they leave prison, which make it effectively impossible for them to reintegrate, for sentencing changes, for sentences, for people to recognize that we have a grotesquely expanded prison system. We have far more people in our prison system than we've ever had before or that any place in the world has ever had.
It's interesting, too, how some of the legislative acts have labels like Public Safety Act, which suggests that letting more people out of prison is in the interest of public safety. And I think that can also be tricky because it can too narrowly focus on or enlist an ideology to counter irrational fears. But what are your thoughts about that?
Well, it's true that keeping people in prison longer is not a way to help them or the rest of us when they get out.
And it addresses kind of an irrational fear of areas of the community, and that people's fears are often manipulated in these punitive anti-crime measures, and that the opposite, they achieve the opposite. But it doesn't necessarily promote more empathy toward people whose lives have been destroyed through the criminal justice system. It still seems to draw on self-interest in white communities.
Well, that's the only interest that really moves people. And the fact is that people in places where prison numbers have gone down, crime has also gone down. It is, in fact, the way to be safer in general is to reduce our reliance on incarceration. And there are a lot of numbers that show that, as well as, you know, your sense of fairness.
And that sense of fairness and equity, I think, is part of what comes up in this report periodically, that you can appeal to people's ideals and sense of fairness and how they've been sold, of course, a false and inflated idea or fantasy of where their fears, the source of their fears, are located in the society, that displaces focus from the real source of insecurity in people's lives.
Well, I think that the focus of terror now is centered on ISIS and is overseas. People can think more rationally now about our criminal justice system, and now is the time to try to really make meaningful changes.
So go to the Sentencing Project and check it out. This is Jan Hawken and Mike Snedeker talking today about public perceptions of race and crime.
Well, that's it for today's Old Mole Variety Hour. I'm Joe Clement, your host. Thanks to Bill Resnick and Walter Sue for talking about public health, for Jan Hawken and Mike Snedeker for bringing us the Left and the Law about racial perceptions of crime, and for James Tracy for talking with me about gentrification, and Fran Michelle for doing the same through her well-read Red. Tune in next week for more news, reviews, and interviews from our radical perspective.
There's a mole with the soil that he stole, and the sightlessness that lets him go free. For every drought, there's a rain, and when my earth's in pain, I watch it boil, oh, tearful. There's a time to sing these these things and a time to have them sung, a time to bring that tune and a time to have it rung. There's a lap for resting
air. And good morning. You are tuned to KBOO Portland. It is just a half a minute before 10 a.m. and coming right up is Air Cascadia with headlines, interviews, and commentary. At 10:15, Locus Focus will have activist and author Sandra Steingraber. She will be talking about why fracking is not a sustainable solution to our energy needs. At 11 on Health Watch, host Dr. David Naiman speaks with Dr. Donnie Wilson about the stress remedy and how stress of all types can disrupt the body's synergy. At 11:30 on the Radio Zine, host Lisa Loving speaks with Jason Mott, New York Times best-selling writer, NAACP Image Award, and author of the new book, The Wonder of All Things. And we would like to thank all you KBOO members for such wonderful support.
This is Sun Lee, KBOO's membership director. Thank you to everyone who called in during our fall membership drive. With your amazing support, we reached our $80,000 goal. We would also like to thank all of our volunteers for doing a great job and for making KBOO a great community and radio station. And thank you to all of the restaurants that provided food. For more information on them, visit kboo.fm/food. We are proud to be your radio station and honored to have your support this fall membership drive. Thank you.
Good morning, Cascadia. Today is Monday, October 13th, 2014, and you're listening to KBOO Portland, your community radio at 90.7 FM, kboo.fm on the web. Today, we're going to be talking about the ordeal of James